Good afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, February 25th, 2021. On today's show, the rural profile of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talks with Wayne Miller, lead author of a 2021 report about rural Arkansas. Their conversation in about 5 minutes. In our second half hour, NWA Ballet readies for a live performance at Walton Arts Center. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth has that story, pirouettes and masks included. And the Walton Arts Center is adding a third performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream from NWA Ballet to their schedule. The previously announced performances for Friday night, March 12th, and Saturday night, March 13th, sold out. This added performance is a Saturday, March 13th matinee at 2. More information at waltonartscenter.org. COVID-19 protocols will be in effect for performers and audiences alike. After Ozarks at Large, 91.3 KUAF has Here and Now. Today, once COVID restrictions lift, musicians from the UK will face new challenges traveling in Europe because of Brexit. That story and other top news of the day on Here and Now, beginning at 1. 10 more fatal cases of COVID-19 are being added to Arkansas's total of virus deaths. The Arkansas Department of Health is also adding 803 new cases after the most recent 24 hours of testing. Active cases have reduced in the last 24 hours by 131, hospitalizations reduced by one patient yesterday. A Stand Your Ground bill is heading to the governor's desk. Yesterday, Arkansas lawmakers approved the bill allowing the use of deadly force in self-defense. Those resorting to lethal force will no longer have to first retreat, which was previously required by the state. We'll have a full report tomorrow on Ozarks at Large. The Fayetteville School Board meeting tonight, going to start a bit later than scheduled. It's now going to start at 5:45 after the board tours the new Child Nutrition and Transportation building. The Cherokee Nation is investing more than $1 million in water and sewer line upgrades in 10 Oklahoma counties. The Nation announced yesterday the $1.3 million worth of upgrades will affect about 18,000 people. Funding for the work comes from the tribe's Respond, Recover, and Rebuild Relief Initiative in conjunction with pandemic relief. The gloves and bats will be in use later today in Fayetteville for both the Arkansas Razorback softball and baseball teams. Home openers for both nationally ranked squads are today. Softball scheduled to host North Dakota State for a doubleheader at Bogle Field. Baseball team meets Southeast Missouri State in Baum Stadium. First pitch for both games set for 3. Good chance of rain tonight. Lows from 36 to 39. 50% chance of rain in northwest Arkansas this evening. 70% chance of rain in the Arkansas River Valley tonight. Clouds tomorrow with a possibility of rain before noon. Highs in the lower 50s. Pleasant Thursday. This is Ozarks at Large. For about 30 years, the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture has produced the Rural Profile of Arkansas. The biennial report aims to provide a greater understanding of the social, demographic, and economic conditions in rural and urban regions in the state. During a conversation about the 2019 report, lead author Wayne Miller told Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda that the loss of businesses in rural areas and continuing migration of youth and talent to urban areas had become a critical concern. Earlier this week, she checked back in with Miller to see if those trends had continued in the 2021 report.
Sadly, they have continued. The U.S. and the Arkansas economies have been growing since 2010. But I think about 70% of the rural counties have lost population during this period of time when Arkansas and the U.S. economies are growing. The same thing with employment. Employment in urban areas is growing, I think, about 13% since 2010, and it's declined in the rural region. Well, in fact, all three of our rural regions of Arkansas during this time of growth. So it's declined from 3% to 7%. And so there are fewer jobs. Of course, people leave because they don't have jobs. I think there's both push and pull factors there. if you're in the rural area, you might not have the amenities that you like, you know, the health care and the entertainment and things that you like. There's also no jobs. And the pull factors for the urban areas are they have some of these amenities available. They have higher paying jobs. And so you have, I think, both push and pull factors at play.
What is the danger or the problem with this trend continuing?
Well, that's a good question, because all rural areas are not going to survive. I mean, we have a global economy now, and so that means the economic base for a lot of these rural regions have changed. I mean, it's no longer they can depend on natural resource industries to generate the jobs and income that they have in the past. Some of that is being done overseas now. So really, they have to reinvent themselves if they want to survive. And all communities probably won't survive. But I think, you know, there needs to be good infrastructure, healthcare, education, if these communities are going to survive.
Obviously, the biggest thing that's been impacting not just rural communities over the last years is the pandemic. But since we are talking about rural communities, how has COVID-19 impacted those communities? Has it created new problems, or is it more just highlighting ones that were already there?
Well, I think it's highlighting problems that were all existed, but probably exacerbated them at the same time. For example, the education issue. If children can't go to school in the classroom, they need access to the internet and to be able to learn. And so I think it's really brought this to the forefront, what rural communities really need to survive. It's not a new issue, but I think it's created a bigger problem for rural communities. And rural communities, you know, have suffered from COVID-19, though, as well, as far as their employment, unemployment, people dropping out of the labor force in rural areas, which is much higher than in urban areas. And so COVID-19 has also affected the local tax base. And rural communities, local governments rely on the sales tax and the property tax to generate a lot of their revenue. When people don't have money to spend, they get less revenue from local sources. And so then it's harder for those communities to develop the infrastructure they need.
I'm glad you brought up the sales tax, because that was something I found interesting in this report. According to your research, 43 of Arkansas's 75 counties increased their county sales tax rate between 2007 and 2020. 39 of those counties are rural, so that means over 60% of rural counties increased their sales tax rate compared to 30% of urban counties. Was that to make up for the loss of that base? And so they increased it, because it seems like if you're going to increase for communities that are historically poorer than urban communities, that's going to be harder for them to come up with. It's going to be more of a strain on them.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a catch-22, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Yes, but that's the reason they have increased their sales tax rate, is try to generate more revenue from a lower tax base. And the same thing goes for the property tax as well. A lot of those counties have increased their millage to make up for a lost assessment, the property tax assessment base on that. But again, at the same time, that makes it harder than for a lot of those residents in the rural areas, because they're paying a higher sales tax rate, you know, than maybe the urban areas.
Right. So that was one of the things that stood out to me. Was there any other statistic that stood out to you in doing this report?
What we need to do is emphasize the infrastructure, and especially the broadband access to and be able to utilize, you know, the broadband internet. And that plays a key role in what communities can or cannot do. I mean, my wife has a personal jewelry business, which she does online. But if we didn't live in Conway, where we had good internet access, she wouldn't be able to do that. I mean, her market is kind of worldwide. And so that's a big constraint that should have been addressed, you know, decades ago. but it hasn't. I mean, and that's a real key issue. But as far as the other areas, I mean, there's some, you know, important concerns, but I guess they're not really surprising because they've been ongoing trends. Of course, the COVID-19 has affected a lot of the minority communities much more than they have, you know, the large white population, and that affects rural communities as well.
According to your report, the population of people in color in Arkansas increased 10% compared to a 2% growth in the white population from 2010 to 2019. How does that break down amongst rural communities?
I don't have those numbers in front of me right now, but in the 2000s, the rural communities received a lot of the minority population to work in factories, the poultry processing plants, or the other ag processing industries, which were in the rural communities. I think recently there hasn't been that growth in the immigration population in rural areas because the employment opportunities haven't been there as well, and they've been more in the urban areas. And so I expect the growth is probably more in the urban areas right now compared to the rural.
So with the decline in the population in rural communities, it makes sense because they're going where the jobs are, they're going where the entertainment is, the opportunity is. In order to keep people in rural communities, you need to offer some of these things that are in urban communities. So it kind of feels like this, like you said, a push or pull. It's this chicken or egg thing. How do you get to a point where you can offer those things in a rural community so that you can have both urban and rural communities in your state, which both have their merits?
Right. And I think some communities have done this. For example, I think Batesville is a good example of what they've done to their downtown area and developing amenities. Harrison, I think, is also doing this. Provide some amenities that, you know, the working age population, especially the younger working age population, likes. And so you have to have, obviously, high-speed broadband and access. You have to have the cafes, you know, the entertainment possibilities. And I think some rural communities offering these amenities can be very attractive to some people, you know, if they have a good educational system at the same time. So you can make investments in some of those amenities kind of thing to try to attract or keep people there. And at the same time, try to encourage entrepreneurship, support the young entrepreneurs who want to start a new business up in your community. And so, you know, I think there are opportunities for communities to attract and keep people there if they provide some of these amenities and opportunities for entrepreneurship and growth.
Anything else you would like to add about the report?
You know, we look at, you know, some of the issues like health and education as well. And it's not new that the rural areas have high infant mortality rates and obesity rates than urban areas. But I think another area, going back to your question about what can rural communities do, I think education is the key. And I think that starts with the pre-K kind of opportunities for children. Investments in pre-K can have very high returns. Make sure your schools are good. And so you produce good quality graduates, and you may have to provide some, you know, workforce education. And I think that's going to be a key for a lot of these rural communities, is to focus on the education. It's a long-term investment, but I think it has high returns. And those communities that can do that, I think, will survive.
That was Wayne Miller, lead author of the 2021 edition of The Rural Profile of Arkansas. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this week. The full report is available at uaex.edu/rural-profile. We'll also share that link on our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
KUAF is supported by Arcom Plus, offering printing, binding, graphic design, promotional items, and more. Now open 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and taking orders through email or phone with curbside delivery. Printing nwa.com or 444-7711 for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. This week, an organization that represents low-income Arkansans filed a lawsuit against the Arkansas Department of Commerce and its Division of Workforce Services. According to Legal Aid of Arkansas, the agency has repeatedly refused to turn over records that might provide a better understanding of why scores of the nonprofit's clients haven't been able to access unemployment benefits during the COVID-19 pandemic. In April, at the start of the health emergency, the jobless rate in Arkansas shot up to over 10% as the virus prompted lockdowns that closed restaurants and other businesses. Arkansans then had to wait weeks for the state to set up its pandemic unemployment assistance program, which allowed self-employed workers to apply for unemployment benefits. Payments were further delayed when a computer programmer discovered a vulnerability in the web application shortly after it launched at the end of May. Since then, unemployment levels have been coming down, most recently to 4.2%. As Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek reports, some Arkansans may have returned to work, but they still haven't received benefits for the time they were unemployed.
While the lawsuit itself focuses on the Arkansas Freedom of Information Act requests submitted to the Division of Workforce Services, attorneys for Legal Aid of Arkansas say its origins go back to the start of 2020. Attorney Jaden Atkins says she and her colleagues filed their first FOIA request for DWS records 4 months ago to get a better understanding of how the agency is operating both its traditional unemployment insurance and the newly created Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program.
We originally started because we recognized that we weren't sure how to help our clients through particular problems that we kept seeing come up.
Atkins says Legal Aid filed two FOIA requests that get at DWS processes. The second request, filed in December, focuses on the work of a contractor called Protex Solutions,
which is the company that created a computer system that effectively makes initial eligibility determinations for PUA claims specifically.
Legal Aid requested to see the weekly and monthly status reports Protech generated for DWS, as well as the training materials involving the services it provides to the agency. Atkins says Protech's algorithms make the initial unemployment eligibility decisions, but DWS employees are supposed to confirm them.
So we wanted some more information about what exactly that is going on there. How is DWS telling them how those decisions should be made, et cetera, et cetera. And the biggest pushback has been on getting that information on the basis that there is a seemingly unrelated data security investigation into Protech.
Legal Aid's lawsuit states the investigation wasn't described as criminal, which is what would shield pertinent data from getting released under the open records law. Trevor Hawkins, an attorney for the nonprofit, says in the last year, the organization has received more calls about unemployment application issues than ever before.
There's such a wide array of issues that folks are facing, but a common thread along all of them is that it's typically related to delays, whether that's in processing applications, you know, making decisions, paying benefits, or processing appeals. That's the common thread there is folks are just waiting and not receiving benefits.
And Hawkins says in the instances that Legal Aid has dealt with, claimants are doing what they're supposed to do to receive unemployment.
I don't think for most people that's a surprise that it was a kind of a broken system to begin with. A lot of these delays and stuff are the result of them not doing anything beyond what they were already doing, not hiring new staff or truly looking at the computers or the technology or maybe algorithms that they were using and evaluating where the hitches were. So they continued, as far as we could tell, business as usual, despite unprecedented claims.
According to Legal Aid, as of mid-December, more than 26,000 unemployment claims have yet to be decided, with about a quarter of Arkansans waiting longer than 3 months, while some claimants are told their wait time could be up to half a year for an initial decision. Jaden Atkins says even when clients follow the necessary steps, the process of filing for unemployment benefits is a long one.
There's the time you have to wait to apply, then there's the time you have to wait to get a decision, then there's the time you have to wait to get a benefit payment. And that's all assuming that you don't have to go through the incredibly complicated appeals process. And by the way, to apply for PUA, you have to apply for UI first. and get denied before you can even try to apply for PUA.
Atkins says legal aid's clients are reporting long lines at unemployment offices and long wait times on the phone, when many don't always have the ability to wait for hours at a time for information.
The reality is they're getting held up everywhere. At every single step of the process.
In addition to months-long applications and appeals processing delays and wrongful denials, Atkins says legal aid clients are also facing unsubstantiated allegations of fraud or overpaid benefits.
For instance, we've seen a number of claimants who were initially approved for traditional unemployment who were then later told, oops, you don't actually apply for traditional unemployment, but it appears to us at least, and in some cases, DWS has said that they are eligible for PUA, but now they are dealing with an overpayment from the traditional UI as well for the period that they received it initially.
Atkins says the nonprofit has also had clients who've been receiving PUA benefits because they were deemed eligible, but they've suddenly been locked out of their accounts.
They don't really know why they're being cut off. They aren't receiving enough information about it. And when they do try to contact DWS, of course, the lines are full too long, or their calls don't go through, or again, they're told they just have to reapply.
Trevor Hawkins says filing the FOIA lawsuit against DWS was Legal Aid's last resort after 4 months of extended deadlines, evasive responses, and withheld documents.
Essentially, a daily basis, we have folks calling us with these unemployment issues, trying to figure out how to navigate them. In the meantime, they're facing very commonly evictions. That's also a relevant part of the pandemic right now. These fluctuations in income, they're left without knowing how they're going to make their car payment. You know, they're facing car repossessions, trying to keep the lights on.
Aside from contacting Legal Aid of Arkansas for assistance, Hawkins has this advice for Arkansans seeking unemployment benefits.
What we've always been telling folks is to be persistent and document every interaction that they have with the Department of Workforce. Every time they try to file a claim and the system wouldn't work, you know, be able to show that they're doing everything that they're supposed to be and that all the shortcomings are on the Division of Workforce Services.
In December, Legal Aid also sued DWS in federal court for discriminating against a Spanish-speaking client who has been waiting 11 months for a decision from the agency. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
Representatives at the Division of Workforce Services told us the agency can't comment on pending litigation, but they did provide some statistics. Since May 21st, DWS has paid out more than $1 billion to nearly 86,000 claimants. And since the Continued Assistance Act extension of the PUA program, which went into effect January 1st, DWS has paid out nearly $80 million to about 29,000 claimants. According to DWS, delays in benefit payments occur when claims require additional review for accuracy or when claimants haven't completed all the steps to have their claims approved. Two main issues could lead to delays in payment: lack of ID verification and lack of valid COVID-19 impact statement from the claimant.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. The state's largest healthcare organization celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. On the program today, we will hear from Baptist Health CEO Troy Wells. Also, a new chief operating officer at Tyson Foods is a familiar name with the company, and a Northwest Arkansas real estate firm is growing its operations in Fort Smith. Those stories are on the way next on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
100 years of being in business is worthy of celebration, but in lieu of the COVID-19 pandemic, Baptist Health CEO Troy Wells says it's prudent to wait until safer conditions can support a public salute. Baptist Health, the state's largest healthcare system, incorporated on February 16, 1921, and has faced a number of turning points in its history. Today, it covers a wide part of Arkansas with 11 hospitals, hundreds of physician clinics, and scores of therapy centers. Here is Troy Wells to discuss the origins of Baptist Health and the 2018 acquisition of Sparks Health System facilities in Fort Smith and Van Buren in a recent interview with Roby Brock.
In 1921, what became Baptist Health was incorporated in Pulaski County, and it actually started the year before. The Baptist State Convention acquired some property in downtown Little Rock in the fall of 1920, and part of that property had the Little Rock Sanitarium, and it had equipment and everything where they could take care of patients. So they began the hospital actually the year before, but on February 16th of 21, that was our incorporation date, and so we recognize that as our birthday, and so just this week, we did celebrate 100 years of Baptist Health in Arkansas, and what started as a small building that could hold 75 patients in downtown Little Rock has become a health system that stretches across the state, 11 hospitals and hundreds of physician clinics and therapy centers, and serving tens and thousands of Arkansans every day, and it's been quite an interesting story to follow for the past 100 years.
Take me back to some of the early days. I'm sure you've looked at some of the history on this. Kind of what was maybe one or two of the really big pivotal moments for Baptist Health? I would think that building that campus right there where you're at right now in the, I want to say the 70s, if I recall correctly, I might be wrong on that, but that had to be one of the major monumental milestones there. What are some things that you've looked at when you've reviewed the history?
Lots of interesting history. The 60s were an interesting period because that's when the convention separated from the hospital and we became a private 501c3 organization. So that was really important in our history when that occurred. And it didn't happen overnight. It took many years of debate and conversation in order for that to occur. But you're correct. 1974, when the hospital campus here in Little Rock was rebuilt and opened, was probably one of the most significant parts of our history, given the location. And back then, you had to take a gravel road to get to the hospital campus. And a lot of people thought that we were crazy, but we had some really smart people in the organization back then that anticipated and had a sense of where Little Rock and the interstate system was going to evolve and how important it would be to have a major medical center right at the intersection of what's now 630 and 430. And of course, that really has played an important part of creating easy access for Arkansans to get to the state's largest hospital.
And I will show my age here. I mean, I know I look young and everything with all the gray on the sides there, but I actually remember all of that because I was a kid that grew up in that end of West Little Rock. I remember those gravel roads and riding bikes to what would be kind of the basin, the bottom of where Baptist is built up on those hills as that interstate was being constructed. But for anybody watching, I'm still in my, I'm still under 50, let's just say. So
well,
I'm going to pretend. So
you're looking great. Well, the other thing too, if you think about it, you know, when we rebuilt the Spring Hill campus in North Little Rock, that's been around for 20 years now. And it seemed like it was built just yesterday. But again, located at an intersection of the interstate of 167 and interstate 40. And then of course we built our Conway campus on I-40. And so we've had good success creating a really good access for people of Arkansas.
And you guys have been in the Fort Smith metro area for a couple of years now with an acquisition up there. Tell me how that integration has gone. And maybe, you know, you've had COVID-19 and obviously, you know, of late some pretty nasty weather here. But tell me how that transition has gone.
It's gone really well. Not to say that we didn't have challenges. Anytime you take that large an organization and try to merge it into another large organization, you're going to have challenges. And things you don't foresee and anticipate, but we've worked through that with their team out west and our team here in Central Arkansas, and they've done a great job. I'm really, really happy with the team that's out west, the caregivers, the physicians, the nurses, the staff. They have done a tremendous job responding to COVID-19. They have meshed well with the rest of the health system. It's just been a wonderful transition great group of people, and we're so excited to have been able to extend our footprint into Western Arkansas.
So, I mean, it begs the question, is there more extension of your footprint potentially in the future?
Well, I don't know that that's part of our plans. I think that we're very comfortable being a regional health system. I think we're a good size. We cover a good geography. The West Edition really was a good fit for us. But we never say never, but we're not aggressively looking to expand necessarily.
That is Troy Wells, the CEO of Little Rock-based Baptist Health, the state's largest healthcare organization. On the COVID-19 front, Wells said with vaccines becoming more widespread, he is hopeful that the pandemic can be conquered. He said if there was one message he had for the public, it is this: be ready when it's your turn to get the COVID-19 vaccine. You can watch that full interview with Roby Brock at talkbusiness.net. Tyson Foods has appointed Group President of Poultry Donnie King to the role of Chief Operating Officer. King took up the position of Group President of Poultry this past September and will continue to serve in that role in addition to his COO duties. King first joined Tyson Foods in 1982 and has since held a variety of executive leadership positions. And Springdale real estate firm Weichert Realtors The Griffin Company has acquired Ramona Roberts Realtors in Fort Smith. It's the second Fort Smith acquisition for the Griffin Company in the past 3 years. Brandon Long, who is a co-owner and broker for the firm, says the agency now has 200 agents, 70 in Springdale, 60 in Bentonville, 45 in Fort Smith, and 25 in Fayetteville. For more news, be sure and visit nwabusinessjournal.com, where you'll find our reporting on regional and state business news each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Northwest Arkansas Ballet Theater is adapting Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream for the stage next month. And the company's first live performance in over a year comes with some new challenges. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth tells us more.
It's late Friday morning, and David Justin is directing a cramped studio of dancers at the Northwest Arkansas Ballet Theater in Bentonville. The company is getting ready for a performance of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, choreographed by Justin, in March at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. And this is a big performance for the company because it's the first time they'll be performing in front of a live audience in over a year.
Now we're ready to finally get back on stage. Thankfully, even though the seats are going to be limited to 200 per performance in Walton Arts Center is a 1,200 seat theater, give or take. But we're going to follow these state-approved COVID guidelines that make it possible for everybody to be safe and limit the audience to 200.
Justin is the executive artistic director of the NWA Ballet Theater, a role that he took on during the height of the pandemic back in July.
And of course, we spent most of the fall trying to reimagine dance and the performing arts in a digital platform where we're not originally designed for a digital platform. You know, of course there's dance on TV and there's lots of stuff out there and available, but as an organization, we're a live performance ensemble. There's something really compelling about being in the room and making a connection with an audience that is very different from the kinds of connections that you make through digital media.
And some of those digital options that the company tried out this past year included straightforward live streams to the more experimental performances, like having camera operators mixed in with dancers or having the camera take the place of an audience member. Justin says while the pandemic put restrictions on what the ballet theater could do, it also forced them to get creative.
When you start working in digital media, the variables expand to a degree, but you know, when you go to the theater and you sit and watch a show, you, the watcher, are in charge of what you watch. The stage could be full of people, and you may focus on one person at one moment and another person another. When you're looking at something that's been produced digitally, the camera is in charge. And so it changes the relationship between makers and viewers. It really is very different.
Dancer and apprentice Kiara Ruff, who operates the company's Instagram live stream rehearsals, agrees that digital options are great to keep people engaged, but says for performing arts that are rooted in the community like this one, live performances are vital.
Oh my goodness, I could cry. I think I probably will cry. Just because performing and just being able to perform for an audience in particular, it's what we do, right? It's just like in any sport, you have so many practices and then you get excited for the big game. It's like that, except we've been practicing for months and months and months with no game. And of course, we've had performances that have been virtual and everything, but it's not quite the same. So I'm beyond excited.
And for dancer Jonathan Carter, who joined the NWA Ballet Theater in August, the upcoming performance comes as a relief.
It's hard. And it's definitely something that you don't really get used to it. You know, it's because having like the live audience when you perform, you know, when you do something and they're like applauding, it kind of gives you that energy to keep going, you know, because it's like just this energy of being on stage. And when you take that away, you don't realize how much that affected you until the audience isn't there.
But getting that audience back for the March shows hasn't been easy. For the Walton Arts Center, that meant moving out rows in its Baum Walker studio to make space for the social distancing regulations. And for the dancers, that meant regular COVID-19 screenings and testings, as well as rehearsing daily in masks.
I gotta say, my lungs have gotten a lot stronger from just wearing masks and exercising for, you know, 6 hours a day. But you just do what you gotta do. And so it's been kind of sad not to be able to perform. But then here we are, it's the light at the end of the tunnel, and we're following all these protocols to make sure that it happens.
And Justin says he thinks the Midsummer Night's Dream performance will be Northwest Arkansas's trial run for live performance in the COVID era.
Under the circumstances, everybody's going to be wearing masks. The audiences will wear masks. The staff of the theater and even the dancers will wear masks on stage as a part of their costumes. So taking the best science that we can, and making the most of our community safety and still being able to produce this work at this time. I just think the audiences are so hungry for it. And I can tell because we originally started only selling one performance. And within a week, we knew that we needed to add a performance. And on the first day that we added those ticket sales, it was already 50% sold.
That second show is now sold out, and the Walton Arts Center has added a third performance since then. Justin says he suspects the growing interest is because people have been starved of live theater for so long.
It may have been just another thing in the past. It really connects with some people, and some people it's not really on their radars. It's very much human nature to desire the thing that you have missed or that you can't have anymore. They also recognize this possibility and the unique ability of the performing arts to inspire them, to create empathy and human connections in sometimes unexpected ways.
The NWA Ballet Theater will perform A Midsummer Night's Dream on March 12th and 13th at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
On March 3rd, that's Wednesday night, join Randy Dixon and myself for a virtual trip through Arkansas history. Randy is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, and every Monday he brings us great archives from the center for an audio trip through time. Well, Wednesday night, March 3rd, We'll be live and we'll add video from some of the favorite archives we've heard over the past year, from the Titan missile explosion to Johnny Cash's nearly forgotten Fayetteville concert in the 1980s to Daisy Bates. You can register to join us by Zoom for free by going to priorcenter.uark.edu. That's priorcenter.uark.edu. Join us Wednesday night for Arkansas News History, exploring the KATV collection. Wednesday night live at 6 p.m.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Music is enough for a lifetime, but a lifetime is not enough for music. A famous quote by Russian composer Sergei Rachmaninoff. We started Sound Perimeter today with Variation 18 from his piece Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, Opus 43. Rachmaninoff wrote this piece for piano and orchestra inspired by the early 19th century violin virtuoso Niccolo Paganini, Caprice No. 24. His Rhapsody is written in 24 variations, and in each of those variations, the composer changes something about the original theme. Variation 18 is written for piano solo. With its tenderness and expressiveness, Variation 18 is the most known and cherished part of the entire work. That was Sergei Rachmaninoff's Variation 18 from his Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini, Opus 43, written in 1934 and inspired by virtuoso violinist, guitarist, and composer Niccolo Paganini's famous Caprice No. 24, interpreted by Ukrainian pianist Valentina Lisitsa as part of her performance with the London Symphony Orchestra. Niccolo Paganini wrote his 24 Caprices around 1807. This piece is considered one of the most difficult works ever written for the solo violin. The most known caprice of this collection is No. 24, and besides being used by Rachmaninoff and Brahms and Liszt and other four variations, it has been transcribed multiple times for different instruments, always highlighting the virtuoso, a highly skilled performer, and the virtuoso performance, one that astonishes the audience by its feats. Let us listen to Paganini's Caprice 24, this time in the hands of Colombian cellist Santiago Cañón Valencia, on an encore live performance from back in 2014 when he was 19 years old. It was Colombian cellist Santiago Cañón Valencia on an encore live performance of Paganini's Caprice 24, originally written for the violin. There are virtuosos in every musical genre, and we hope for a life long enough to enjoy them. We close Symphony Mirror today with one of them, American bassist, songwriter, and record producer, 5 times Grammy winner and founding member of the group Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, Victor Wooten, and his original piece The Lesson, making the bass sound like no one does, with virtuosism, emotion, and commitment. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Thank you.
And you can hear Sound Perimeter from Leah Uribe almost every Thursday in our program, or when you'd like, by subscribing to the free Ozarks at Large podcast. Our podcast is available through any of the major podcast distributors. You can also ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent daily edition of our show. The University of Arkansas is preparing for spring commencement. 21 separate ceremonies will take place on campus between May 6th and 8th. Each will adhere to health and safety policies and protocols. Similar to the fall commencement ceremonies, spring commencement ceremonies will be limited in attendance with a condensed program. Social distancing and mask wearing will be required. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team is improving as the late regular season schedule continues. Last night, the number 20 in the country Razorbacks defeated number 8 Alabama by double digits in Bud Walton Arena. It is the 8th straight SEC win for Arkansas. Last night's game, the first matchup between two top 20 teams in Bud Walton Arena in 23 years. The John Brown University men's basketball teams will play in the Sooner Athletic Conference Tournament semifinals Saturday after last night's 66-55 win over Wayland Baptist. The JBU women's season is over after just 11 games, this coming after a JBU quarterfinal loss to the University of Science and Arts, Oklahoma. The women's season was delayed and interrupted often to observe COVID-19 protocols. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith men's basketball regular season concludes with two games on campus this weekend. The Lions will host St. Edward's University Friday night and Saturday afternoon. The UAFS women's regular season is done after the cancellation of their two games against St. Edward's this weekend.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for KUAF comes from the Malco Theaters, offering reserved recliner seating and following all COVID-19 safety guidelines at the Rogers Cinema Grill and Razorback Cinema Grill and IMAX Theater in Fayetteville. Showtimes, tickets, and information available at malco.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Harrison. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors this Thursday included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, Zuzanna Sitek, and Leah Uribe. Timothy Dennis produced today's show in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Lee Wood produced this week's Sound Perimeter, and Stephanie Brock puts together the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. That's part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl is still often performing live at around 4 o'clock our time every afternoon on his Facebook and Instagram feeds. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 for a brand new Friday edition of Ozarks at Large. You can find out more about us at ozarksatlarge.com. There you can find full shows, individual stories and interviews, plus links that allow you to share all of that with friends through email and social media. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio in the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for being with us. Please take care of yourself.